Hey there, I'm Beth Donaldson, an entrepreneur that puts hustle and heart into everything I do. The Hustle and Heart podcast will give you real and raw advice about overcoming and embracing failures, challenges, and obstacles in order to climb to the top. But it all begins with you. Listen in to each episode to harness your power and achieve more than you ever thought possible. Get ready to own it all because you deserve it. Hey there, and welcome back to a super exciting episode of the Hustle and Heart podcast. Today's episode is all about why price, competition, and the economy can never impact your success, despite what others may think. You've probably heard it all before. The market is tough, the economy is in shambles, the competition is too fierce, but guess what? None of that has to hold you back. Your success is not dictated by external forces. It's built from within. And today, we have the absolute powerhouse in the business world joining us, Dean Akers. Dean is an adjunct CEO who has spent over four decades leading companies to hyper growth. He helps CEOs and business owners break through roadblocks, scale their businesses, and create massive impact. And he happens to be one of my personal favorite leaders, as I have had the honor to work with him for many years while I was at Ideal Image, where he was the CEO and inspired me on many levels when I was new to the aesthetic world. Beyond that, Dean is deeply committed to helping transitioning military veterans finding rewarding careers. He's also the founder and host of The Condo Coaches, providing expert guidance to HOA and condo associations. Hey, Dean, it's so great to have you on. Welcome to the Hustle and Heart podcast. Let's get this party started. I just have to say that I am thrilled and extremely grateful to have you on today as one of my personal mentors throughout my aesthetic career, and can't wait to just get started with this conversation. So let's go ahead and jump right into the three circle process and our conversation. Can you tell us, I know you've worked with countless CEOs and business owners, what's the biggest misconception about success in business?
Well, I think what I've found is a lot of business owners usually start their company out of disgust with their previous owner, boss, or whatever, and they start a company and they generally have one of the legs of a business very strong, and they're usually their strongest leg is operations in most businesses. And they've always wanted to do it differently than the company they were with, or they could do it better. The three legs are finance, operations, sales, and marketing. Beth, I want to ask you, what happens on a three-legged stool when one of the legs is shorter than the other one?
We break.
Yeah, wobbles or falls over. You're right. And so what happens is, I just finished with a company I'm helping. In fact, I'm not going to disclose it today, but I'm probably going to take a CEO role. I swore I would never do it again, but at any rate, when we've increased their sales almost by 40% in the last 6 months by some of this stuff we're going to talk about today. It's crazy. It's crazy the opportunities that are out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I'm a huge advocate of the sales, and that's such a big part of a business. So I can't wait to jump into that with you.
Most people don't understand one of those legs, and it cripples them.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about the three circle process and how price, competition, and the economy can never impact your success. What inspired this belief and this process that you've kind of created and you talk about a lot when you're doing, I know you're speaking across the country and with different organizations. What inspired this belief?
I was a young man. I graduated in 1974 from the University of Florida, go Gators. And I went to work for a construction equipment company in sales training. They put me in the worst territory in the company where three people had previously failed because they could only make $7,500 a year. And that's what I was making as a trainee. And I went up there and everybody was talking about competition, price, and everything else. And I go up there. Well, these were my headwinds. My office was 100 miles away from the territory they put me in. The territory they put me in had the top three competitors there: Caterpillar, John Deere, and International. This was 1975 when I went into the territory. We were selling construction equipment. Three people had failed. and I get thrown up there in this territory to be the fourth failure, and these were my headwinds. The three largest competitors had offices and parts and service and inventory in the marketplace. Our offices were over 100 miles away. We weren't even a top three brand or competitor. So that's a pretty bad headwind, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I would definitely say that, for sure.
Guess how much bad worse it got.
But I know it didn't stop you.
Well, what happened was, this is how bad it was. These people had failed. I'm stuck up there, and I go, you know, I'm going to fail too. However, oh, by the other headwind, we were the early importers of Japanese equipment. Our average customer was a 50-year-old male. Guess what he was doing when he was 18 years old?
What?
Fighting in World War II against the Japanese.
Oh, yeah.
So we're trying to sell Japanese equipment to bomber pilots.
Wow.
So I had every headwind. I went up there and I came up with a concept of building relationships and losing sales. But I wanted to have a good enough relationship with every one of the people in the territory, every potential customer, that they would tell me they would not buy from me when they were actually doing the transaction.
Mm-hmm.
I would lose the sale. Well, what happened was I went up there, I built relationships. I had people tell me they would never buy from me. And a year and a half later, I made my first $100,000 as a 25-year-old.
Wow.
And a lot of money.
$100,000, you know, in the 70s is a lot different. That would look a lot different these days.
No, I was stupid rich.
Yeah, exactly.
I was single. And I was, yeah. But the long and short of it, the economy went in the tank in 1982. And we had the meltdown of all the banks, and everybody was moaning. Our company was, every sales had dropped from 60 million to 50 million, and everybody was moaning and everything. And I came in, and that's when the three circles, I showed them the three circles. And the three circles, if you took a piece of paper out right now, Beth, and you drew three circles across the piece of paper in a row, in the first one, you put your current sales, whatever they were. I'll just use Linder back then, it was 50 million. Is what we were doing all over the state. And now I'm the executive as a 27 and a half year old getting ready to run the company. And I bring the whole team together. And I go, guys, we're at 50 million. And everybody's going, yeah, the economy and price and all this other stuff. And I go, okay, I got the gross market value at the time. And at the time it was $1 billion. So I took our sales, 50 million, plus our lost sales, which everybody said they closed 20-30%. And I said, let's assume we lost another 50 million. That's 100 million. 100 million minus a billion is how much? It was 900 million. That's circle two. You take circle three, which is the billion. Circle one is your sales and your gross sales you lost for whatever reason you thought you lost them. And then the circle two is just the math of those taken off. Well, circle two was was $900 million. I brought the whole team together. I go, we lost $900 million for one reason, which was why, Beth?
Relationships and, you know, excuses, quite frankly, in my opinion, and not building those relationships.
But it's even worse than that. It's worse. We didn't even know about it. They didn't even choose us because we were too high priced. They didn't choose us because our stuff was not good. They didn't choose us because of any other reason that we didn't know about it. So I went out and had our team go start calling on customers. This is B2B, not B2C, which is what you're in. But at any rate, we started calling on customers. And within 2 years, in a recession, we hit $103 million.
Wow.
We made so much money, it was stupid.
That's amazing. I love that you share, Dean, how you were able to go into one of their most underperforming territories and turn that around, because I remember in the days of us working together at Ideal Image, and when I was promoted to the national lead consultant, where I was able to go to the underperforming clinics or new clinics, and when a lot of colleagues or people would say things like, oh, you know, Beth just had those numbers because she was in a clinic that had clientele, that had money and this and that. But really, I was able to take the same approach with building relationships and executing the same exact numbers, regardless of where I would go, to quote these underperforming clinics and to brand new clinics and still execute at the same level. So definitely the price was not a thing, competition is not a thing, and the economy wasn't a thing.
Yeah, it never is. I mean, I've gone into a number of companies. I've been a CEO of a number of different industries over the last bunch of years, including my own company, which was a tire company. We were the largest tire company in Florida commercially when I sold out at 40 to retire. I've never lost the bet with a CEO that price, competition, and the economy are not your issue. I've never lost the bet ever. And I've been on national stages speaking and had people pull the paper out, and it just shuts them up when they do the three circles.
That's amazing. I love that. That's great. What do you feel like, what role does mindset play in overcoming these struggles and roadblocks and just business struggles in general?
It plays like 99%. People.
Yeah.
I wrote my second book, Beth, called Self-Talk, Think Like a Child. And my passion now as a 70, I'll be 73 this year, is my passion is eliminating the number one disease on the planet, bigger than cancer, bigger than anything. And it's a disease of negative self-talk to yourself. People start believing stuff that's just not true.
Yep, I agree with that. And what you believe you achieve. So if it's all negativity and not positive, you aren't going to achieve those things.
And that's what I learned when I don't joke at all, but lose sales. You know, and the one thing I found too, especially in your kind of industry and some of the companies I help, when people learn, this is another superpower. You want another superpower?
I want to know it.
The open-ended question and shutting up.
Yes, yes. I preach that all the time. The open-ended questions are so powerful.
And then shutting up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's funny is I have these things, and I'd be glad to mail you one. You'd get a kick out of it. I bought ponchos, those little plastic ponchos in little baggies.
Uh-huh.
And I give them to all my sales ninjas. On the thing, it says, this is a customer presentation puke protector. This is being handed to you by your non-performing salesperson for your safety while we puke all over you, our presentation.
I love that.
Because when you start puking on customers, you're not listening, you're not asking questions, you're not letting them engage. And you know, one of my favorite stories, in fact, I told it today at this meeting because I'm helping a cosmetic surgery group and I'm looking at maybe taking a CEO role there. And I was sitting there and we were talking and I go, you know what's the craziest thing that we did at Ideal Image? And I'll never forget it. We used to send handwritten notes, as you know.
Okay.
And one of my favorites were we would send cards and stuff out at the holidays to different people. And one of them was at Thanksgiving, we would mail a pie recipe. And the funny thing is we would mail and keep people in our contact field that were blondes. And do you remember what we could do with a blonde back then?
Not very much.
And somebody asked me, they go, why would you care about a blonde? I said, well, our marketing brought the blonde in, okay? We can't treat them, but 95% of the United States is not blonde. So when she's having lunch and she says, Susie over at Ideal Image sent me a recipe for a pie for Thanksgiving and a kind note, and I can't even buy from them. Well, who is she sitting at lunch with?
Right. It's so powerful, that relationship and just that extra contact. Like, people remember it. And even you send me cards still to this day. And there's nothing more powerful or more impactful than getting a handwritten card by someone. And yeah, so of course, with that extra connection, like, they're going to refer their friend, like, wow, I can't even purchase from them, but they're thinking about me and they truly care. And sometimes the blondes did have dark hair in their underarms or one of the areas, but either way, that's so powerful. I love that. And handwritten cards go a long way.
The superpower there is what when you do the cards and stuff, and I get all my team's note cards and stuff, and they send birthdays out. and different things, and I go, the superpower there is you're keeping brand awareness. Did I ever tell you how I ended up at Ideal Image?
I don't think I know that story.
I was retired, totally retired. I sold my construction company, and I was retired, and I was bumming around, and a buddy of mine called me up that had an IT company. He says, would you come talk to these two chiropractors? So I went to talk to Joe and Rick, and I walked in, and they asked me some questions. I told them what I do, and they disagreed. And I said, well, you know what? I don't have a dog in your fight. So-and-so invite Mark asked me to come in and talk to you or visit with you, and I'm great. I'm good. I said, but I would be doing this a little different. And they had been in business 7 years in that office at West Shore.
Mm-hmm.
I go, you guys are missing out big time. And they, you know, I almost offended them, which I didn't give a crap about.
Yeah.
Weeks later, they called me up and they go, would you come see us again? So I went back in, and that's where I took the role of CEO and ownership position. And we grew it to 67 locations with your lovely help and the help of many others. To, as you remember, we had, what, $170 million exit?
Oh, yeah.
And so that was all on the heels of eliminating self-talk. And I told the story about our when we had our first six locations or five locations. And we were sitting there and people were bitching about price. You know, the women, the saleswomen, because that's all we had back then. And I brought them all in the room. I don't know if I ever told you this. Did I ever tell you this story?
No.
I had to, because you would have been an advocate for it. Do you remember the story about bringing them in and asking them why they carry a purse?
No, I don't think I heard that story.
You were way late in the deal. So I brought the women in and we all sitting in the conference room and I go, and we had our five locations. I go, why do you ladies carry a purse? Because they were bitching about price because everybody was offering $500 laser hair and we were at $1,500. And they were all bitching about, oh, you know, they're marketing $500, we're $1,500, blah, blah, blah. That was our average. And I go, so I said, well, y'all are going to decide who we're going to be because I'm okay with whatever you want to do. I ask them, why do you carry a purse? Beth, why do you carry a purse?
To hold all my crap. But I, you know, I got to get that good purse too. So.
But listen what happened. So they all said to hold my crap. I said, so if it was always empty, 365 days a year, would you carry an empty purse? The answer was no.
No, yeah.
No, you wouldn't always carry every day, all day, an empty purse. It's to hold your junk. I said, would you ladies please do me a favor? Would you put your purses on the table? Which they did. And I sat there and I looked at the first one. I said, can you tell me about your purse? And she goes, what do you mean? I don't know. What is it, a brand purse, whatever? And she goes, oh, it's a Kate Spade, blah, blah, blah. And she, how much did you pay? Well, I paid $800. Second girl had some similar one. The third one had a brown Louis Vuitton. I knew how much they were because I had bought my wife one. And she goes, it's a brown Louis. And I go, well, how much did you pay? And she goes, $2,200. Beth, you cannot make this up. That day, the other woman next to her had a white Louis. And I didn't know what a white Louis was. All the other girls started giggling. And I go, what is that? I could see the logos. And she goes, it's a Louis. And I go, what'd you pay? She goes, $4,200. I went, wow. And then we went, the other one had like a $1,000 purse. So I go, so here's what y'all are going to decide. I'm okay being either one. I pulled out an insert from the paper, because back then we got a newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
It was from a small retailer by the name of Walmart. And
yep.
Exactly. And I picked it up, and up in the top corner of one of the pages was a 100% calfskin purse. Brass buckle, whole corner thing, $39.95. So I looked at all the ladies and I go, this will carry everything. Can I ask you a question? They all go, yeah. I said, do you think the people at Louis Vuitton are freaking out that the largest retailer, $500 billion in sales, is coming after their purse business? Do you think the Louis Vuitton people are freaking out?
No. Do you want to be a Walmart or do you want to be a Louis Vuitton? I love that.
That's what I asked him. I looked at the first one dead in her face and I go, who do you want to be, Walmart or Louis Vuitton? And guess what she said?
Louis Vuitton.
The second one, same question. What do you think she said?
Louis Vuitton.
What did the third one say?
Louis Vuitton.
We went around. What did they all say?
Louis Vuitton.
I leaned up on the conference table. This changed Ideal Image that day because it changed our culture. I leaned up on the table and I'm going to use the exact words. I know it's inappropriate. I said, then start fucking acting like.
Good. And we keep it real on Hustle and Heart. So that's good. And you're right.
Yes.
Start acting like it.
Yes. Our average sale price doubled. Our average close ratio doubled in those locations. And the culture of the company was set, which you were a part of later on, that allowed us to be the largest laser hair removal company in the country, most expensive, highest touch points. And of course, I was in it for the exit. I wasn't for a job, and we had that huge exit 6 years later.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I started at 6 locations, and when I left, we were at 132 locations, and we were the Louis Vuitton. And the interesting thing about it, when I look back, you know, those were the days when we were only laser hair removal.
Correct. Do you remember why that happened?
We were the experts at the time with just laser hair removal.
That wasn't the reason.
What was the reason?
I never told you this.
I don't think I heard that either.
Oh, this is just a good Beth Deaton catch up. I did the demographics. This is another thing for all your listeners. You got to know who your customer is, not who you think it is, who it is. And there's so much research available today to do that. Well, I asked Joe and Rick, I said, who's our customer? And they go, well, our average customer is a 40-year-old. Okay, great. What's our household income? 72 grand. Okay, made sense. And we were advertising all over Tampa Bay. I go, where do they come from? They go, oh, they come from all over. This is when we were first meeting. And I go, okay, so we have average household income, 72, average age, 40, and they come from all over. And we were doing Botox and all this other stuff at the time. We were a med spa like you are now. And I looked at it, but our biggest business was hair removal. So I did the deep dive on our customers. Guess what our average customer's age was?
30.
32. You were close. So it wasn't 40. You think we missed that by a boatload?
Yeah.
Guess what the average household income was for our hair removal patients?
Probably less than 72.
38 grand.
Yep.
And guess what the drive time to our location on West Shore was? Average. All the patients for 7 years.
How far?
10 minutes.
Oh, wow.
So when I did all the demographics, that's why I was even able to open up 5 locations immediately. And because they had advertised for 7 years on the radio and all that crap, the day I opened every one of those locations, they were max capacity that literally day. Because when we said we just now opened in Brandon, bam, all the people in Brandon that never came to us came there. We're now open in, you know, North Tampa, Wesley Chapel, bam, filled up that day, not like took months and months. So that's why I share with people, you got to know your facts and know your demographics and know them cold. Don't assume. Don't go between 40 and 50. No, find the exact bell point. Is it 42? Is it 45? And then you know why we were able to raise money, which was crazy. When people said they looked at me and they go, how do we know this isn't a fad when I raise capital for us? And I go, well, I'm going to give you one benchmark and then you guys can tell me what you think. Our average patient is a 32-year-old female. And I will tell you 90% of the CEOs I present to do not know this fact. Guess what the 32-year-old female represented as a market opportunity at the time?
What?
It was the lowest birth rate ever in U.S. history pre-baby boomer.
And you know what's really intriguing to me about this, and this goes back to price is never a factor, and you should never get so involved in what someone's money is. $38,000 and the success of the organization, $38,000 for the average income of the clientele, people are going to buy what they see value in, period, end of story.
You know, the other thing I shared on the stage, besides the market sizes and the age was a huge thing because we were able to show that there was going to be huge growth coming in with the baby, well, not baby boomers, Gen X, Gen Y coming in with the growth. But with the 37 grand, you know what the other one, on stage to private equity groups, guess what I ask them? I said, do you know what our number one procedure at Ideal Image is? And guess what it was?
Laser hair removal?
Well, that was the only thing we did at the time.
Yeah.
Our number one area was facial. And that was our number one area, hands down. Every guy always thought it was Brazilian. You know, that's what they thought. But it was actually facial hair. And women will tell their girlfriends they're having an affair before they'll tell them they're shaving every day. I'm talking about their face.
Yeah, it's a very embarrassing thing for women, and we normalized it. And that's a big part of my success, is hitting those emotional triggers, you know, with people, because when they're dealing with facial hair, like, that doesn't surprise me at all that they would share that they're having an affair before they tell them they're shaving their face or tweezing their face.
You're right. It's emotional. That goes back to what we talked earlier about sales. But here's the question I posed to everybody when they thought about the industry being, you know, tough. I go, I'm going to give you one other reference point, and you guys can decide if I'm right or wrong. But this is my reference point for our number one procedure. Since biblical times, women with beards has not been fashionable. And the whole place erupted in laughter. I said, so does it make sense what I'm sharing? We're in the lowest demographic as far as birth rate. We have household income of 37, and our number one procedure is facial hair, which women are so embarrassed about. How can it fail? Which it didn't, and we went on to be mega successful with people like you.
That's awesome. I love it. And the prices kept going up, by the way, because the value went up, and we just took it to a whole new level.
Yeah. And you're a stud. I mean, I always joke, and I know I probably embellish this, but I go, our number one salesperson at the time, or our number one salesperson in the whole United States, was Beth Donaldson, and she was in Quivecourt, Missouri. I mean, Jesus.
Right in front of a bus stop, by the way.
These girls in Miami, and stuff, I said, are you kidding me? That shows you that it's all about the relationship, people, and connection.
Absolutely. I love that. I miss those days. Those were fun days. I loved it.
A lot of fun. But you know what? You're doing it now. What I would share with you with your business is make sure you go back to those basics. Know your demographics. Totally look at that distance. Study that stuff. And then really target that, and really you can hyper grow any business. And I've done it in every space, so I know it works.
Yeah, absolutely. How do you feel like entrepreneurs and business owners can stay resilient when everything seems to be against them?
Well, they start believing their own crap. I'll give you an example. My son, my number three son, who ended up marrying my right-handed Ideal Image, who you know, Misty.
Misty's the one that hired me.
I know. And Misty, at any rate, they got married. Well, you know what business they're in now, don't you?
Yeah, the candle pour, and they're doing amazing. Yeah.
So listen what happened. This will show you how you deal with things like this. COVID hit, right?
Mm-hmm.
Pretty big, devastating deal. Would you agree?
I agree.
Dennis calls me up. This is comical. He calls me up because, Dad, we're out of business. I go, what are you talking about? He goes, COVID hit. They shut our first, this is when they just had opened up in Hyde Park. They've been there like 6-8 months or whatever. He goes, they shut our whole place down, everywhere, shut down. I go, Dennis, do I have to get my butt in a car and come beat your butt? He goes, what, Dad? I said, you're self-talking. You've got to pivot and figure it out. Think of something. I want you not to talk about what's wrong with everything. Tell me how you're going to fix it. And mm-hmm. about an hour later, he calls me up and he goes, I figured it out, Dad. I go, what? He goes, I'm not telling you. Guess what he did, Beth? Guess what he did, which was epic.
What'd he do? I know he did something epic, because I know they're growing and booming. That's awesome.
Oh, this is funny. This is comical. He called the local TV stations, all three of them, and they weren't doing anything. Everybody was shut down. He called them up and said, look, we're taking candles to first responders, nurses, doctors, and everything, to tell them thank you. Just want to let you know. He had the three TV stations follow them around, giving candles out to nurses and doctors and people with COVID, saying thank you for taking care of us. Their website blew up with people donating money to buy candles for first responders.
Wow.
And they had to set up a whole business, which now they have a big building north of the airport where they manufacture candles and stuff. But it all was on the heels of helping people and pivoting. Instead of saying we're going to be shut down, what can we do different? Then they called all their prior customers and said, we know you're in COVID. Do you need us to make earthy sage or whatever the candle they bought was for you while you're in lockdown? And they go, yeah, could you make me 10 of them? And these are $50 candles.
Yeah.
They had one lady who bought, I think, 250 candles because she's really wealthy and she's the wife of a big sports team here. And she had come there and had candle experience, but she bought 250 of them to give out to people.
That's amazing. And like you said, it's about pivoting during those moments and innovation in your business.
Totally. So the reason I'm sharing that, that's how, back to your question, how do they get around things that are against them? Quit believing things are against you.
They're happening for you, right?
Exactly. Let everybody else that's bitching about the circumstance, let them go down their road. You pivot, you figure out how to make, you know, something out of it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's get back to pricing a little bit, because I feel like, especially in our industry, or even when you're talking about the $50 candles, obviously they're high quality and the whole experience that they offer with it, but just pricing in general, I feel like many businesses worry about pricing and they're always trying to compete on pricing. Let's talk a little bit more about what your take is on, you know, that approach.
Well, one of the things I always ask customers when they bring up price, in even, you know, if they go, oh, that price is more than I, my favorite question, and I've asked this question many, many times, and it's made me a lot of money. Back when I was a very young man, I developed this. I ask them if they say, oh, the prices and blah, 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 blah. And I go, let me ask you this. If all the prices were legislated the same today, would you choose us? And then just shut up. And if they go, that's a closed in question. They're going to go, well, yeah, I'd choose you. Or if they say no, it doesn't matter. Whatever they say, you go, why? And they go, well, I'd choose you because of this and that or other, because of your play, whatever the reason is, drive time, whatever it is. And they go, well, then we've got to figure out how to do this, don't we? And they go, and you know what? I've had almost 99.99% of all the customers ever say when I ask that question.
What do you say?
They say, you're right, just do it.
Right, because I mean, ultimately, price is not a thing. And for most organizations that are offering something valuable, they are not going to want that kind of clientele anyway.
Well, you don't even, that kind of clientele actually, you know, if you look at Dennis with his $50 candles, you look at Ideal Image, where we were the most expensive in the marketplace. You look at some of the companies I'm helping now, you know, I have a cosmetic surgery group, and we just raised all our prices a bunch. And my senior team goes, well, the salespeople are bitching. I said, they always bitch. Don't worry about it. Teach them how to make money. And they now my teams are closing higher than they've ever closed at a higher price. And we're having a lot of fun. And more importantly, we have satisfied customers, which is why you're in business.
Exactly. That's awesome. So I'm really excited to talk about this next topic, because you and I worked together in 2008 during what most people call like the biggest economic crisis. And during that time, we broke records. It was like an amazing year for us as a company and as a team. And I know you kind of hit on this already, but if you want to dive a little bit deeper on how companies should adapt when they're faced with economic downturns.
Well, going back to the three circles will always prove that you're irrelevant in market share. So if you're sitting there doing 10 million in sales and you determine that the gross market is 100 million, we'll use small numbers, okay? So you sit there and you look at it and you go, wait a minute. And then you calculate what sales you lost, where people came in and left for whatever reason. They bought because they left for whatever reason, doesn't matter. So now your traffic is 20 million. You go back to the, I lost 80 million for one reason, not because of the economy, not because of, I lost 80 million because they don't even know who I am. So this could go back into your marketing. It could go back into your strategies of touching customers. It's a lot of things, but that, I did a speaking engagement with a bunch of YPOers, young presidents recently. And there was this one arrogant guy, third generation on the front row. And you could tell he was, yeah, they were a big company, big company. We did the three circles and he was at $1 billion in revenue. So that's pretty legit. When we did the three circles and he did the third circle and he put what the gross market where he serviced was, this is his numbers, not mine. It was $1 trillion.
Wow.
It shut him up so fast, and I didn't try to shut him up. He sent his jet to take me to Miami.
That's awesome. And so what do you think during that time, if you want to share with the listeners, just because so many people were freaking out in 2008, and then of course again during COVID, but what was it within our team and organization that you feel like really, how'd we have a record-breaking year in 2008 when everyone else was freaking out?
Well, because we weren't freaking out, A. B, we knew our number one procedure was what women wanted. And C, we marketed. If you remember right, one thing Rick did really well, and we had a whole team, was the marketing. You know, we had customers that were reaching out to us. We created brand awareness for, back then all we did was laser hair removal. We had a lot of traffic. When other people were sitting around going, I can't figure out how to get business. Most people don't look at marketing and understand their cost per lead and their cost per consult and their cost per acquisition. When you start doing the math on lead costs and acquisition costs through marketing, you find you can spend a lot of money. And it's just dollars. And when you do that, that's how we were able to spend millions of dollars. And nobody could understand how could they afford to spend that kind of money, because it wasn't millions of dollars. It was X dollars per lead. Then we knew how many deals you guys closed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to know your cost per lead is extremely important. And I agree, our marketing was out of this world. But it also took a team of executors under leadership like you that makes it happen, because you can also get all these leads in the world, and if they're not being executed, then the marketing dollars are wasted.
Well, I'm actually dealing with that now, right now, as we speak. I just came from a meeting and I built a template, and the template in this particular company shows we have appointment setters that actually get the lead and set for you to come in. Well, essentially they suck. And so what I did was, they were all on salary. We paid them like $25 an hour, and they were sitting in a call center and they weren't really producing, and they got like a couple bucks if a lead showed. Okay. So I changed them to 100% commission, and now I pay them $150 every lead that shows. But I backed into the math at what they were making. And so now I sit with them and I go, I want to teach you how to make 200 grand. How many of those ladies that are setting the appointments to get, and they get it per show, how many of them do you think have ever made even 100 grand?
Probably not many.
Try zero.
And if they were used to being paid a base salary, sometimes I find those kind of people don't have the mindset to work on commission too. So sometimes changing that, was that challenging, or did you have to hire a new team that had a different mindset? Because I mean, I know it can be very lucrative, but you got to be an executor, because it does start with the leads. If they're not getting them in the door, then it kind of is a waterfall effect and a domino effect for your whole organization.
Yeah. So what I did with the ladies, and they were all like these 50 grand a year ladies, and you know, their total bonuses were like 2 grand, you know, so say they make 52 grand. I told them, I'm going to give you a 10% raise and guarantee you that amount of money, but I'm going to turn it into 100% commission at $150 a show. And I went through the math with them, and one of them looks at me and she goes, what if I can't make 50 grand? I said, that's going to be the least of your problems.
Yeah, if you're not making 50 grand, you're probably not a good fit because the opportunity is 200 grand.
Yeah, so now I got all these, well, the opportunity is even bigger than that. Guess what their opportunity is based on their lead? 600 grand.
So, yeah, unlimited, yeah, right?
It's not unlimited, 600 grand based on their leads if they got paid $150 a lead. But they'll never make six, because you won't get all of them. But here's the math. As a leader, all I do is coach and help them. We have really a lot of success with it, but we still suck. When we get really good at this, it's going to change this whole company by probably, if you look at our leads and you do the math on it, our total gross lead value today is 300 million. We're going to do about 9 million. So our marketing team's doing an epic job. Our appointment setters for getting people in are horrific. And now I'm getting them dialed up and I'm able to hire people that are excited about making 200 grand. And when they make 200 grand, we're going to make so much money, it's stupid.
I don't think too much money is stupid, but I think that's amazing that, again, we have a lead generation and knowing and understanding what you're paying per lead, but having those people execute it is the most important part so we can get them in the door. But 200,000 isn't stupid. That's awesome. I love it.
What we did before, which has been a big cultural change for this company, I got management to quit managing. And we've turned the organization into an empowered organization now. We only have 50 employees today, but we're growing. Now that we have an empowered organization and they're really feeling it, all of a sudden, we're getting ideas from our practitioners, our MAs, and everybody, and it's just turned into this high energy. And then the other big thing is, which we talked about at the very onset, was the financial side. Most of the people don't even know how to read their own financials, and now I'm giving literally everybody on the team financials. I have the financials broken out by location, so I have my location managers are getting financials. I'm essentially following the Outback model that I learned from the founders of Outback Steakhouses years ago. And I'm giving them all my location managers 10% of the net. And we're rocking and we're growing and I'm hiring people literally every day.
That's amazing. When you say that you're having your managers stop managing, what do you mean by that?
Beth, you're going to laugh. I get a recorder pen and I have them wear it for a day in their pocket. And then we take it to Grammarly or one of those softwares and we transcribe what the day was of their conversation. And guess what happens?
What?
They're managing. They're telling everybody what to do. They're not asking open-ended questions and shutting up. And you can train wreck before the crash site.
And letting them lead in their roles.
Well, you're sitting there like the front desk. I asked one of the front desk ladies, been with 7 years. I go, what would you do different? This is after they trust me because I do my handwritten notes and all that. And she goes, can I be honest with you, Dean? And I'm sitting up at the front desk at one of our locations. I go, yeah. She goes, you see how our screen sits here where the patients really can't see when they come in and everything? I go, yeah, what would you do different? She goes, we need to move it over here. I go, why wouldn't you move it over there? She goes, because when they did the build out, they didn't put a place for my keyboard. I went, really? So she kept telling me all the stuff. I go, well, if that makes sense, why wouldn't we do it? And she goes, and you want to hear what she said to me that day?
Yes, I do.
Nobody ever listens to us.
Wow.
Guess what was done within 2 days?
The computer was moved.
And the keyboard was exactly where she wanted it. Guess how empowered she is. And oh, by the way, this woman, she's 50-something. And everybody goes, oh, you know, she's not start talking about. I'm just talking to them. I go, tell me about her. She'd been with us for a while. They go, what do you mean? I go, tell me about her background. How'd she grow up? And I'd already hung out with her a little bit, and I do it with everybody, as you know. I mean, I came to St. Louis and stuff. Guess what this woman, when she was 20 years old, this woman that people don't think's motivated, guess what she was doing when she was 20 years old?
Sales.
No, she was a cheerleader for the Miami Dolphins.
Oh, wow.
She is a stud, but nobody pays any attention. She's 50 now. You know, she's I'd call attractive, but what do you know about somebody that went through competitive dance, became a cheerleader for an NFL team? What do you know about them immediately?
They're competitive. They probably build great relationships. They have worked hard, you know, like I'm sure there's a lot to it. And not to mention her 50 years and her tenure with the company, like her thoughts should be valued.
100%. And guess what? Now that I've empowered this woman, she's like on fire.
That's amazing. I love that.
It's what gets me out of bed in the morning at my age. I don't need to work anymore, but I get out of bed and I love watching people discover their own successes.
Yeah, and getting out of their own way. Because a lot of times I feel like that's what it is. People are in their own way with their own thoughts and the negativity. And if we get out of our own way, we can just build an amazing life and career.
You just broke the code, Beth. You just broke the code.
I love it. What do you feel like are some key habits of CEOs and entrepreneurs who thrive regardless of competition?
One is know the facts, understand your financials to a T, and empower your teams so that they give them. When I had my construction company, I had 350 employees, and we did civil contracting, roads and bridges and stuff, and underground. Guess what I gave every employee every month?
I can only imagine.
Full financial statement of the whole company.
Let me ask you this. Did you do that even when an employee was brand new, before they understood, like, you know, the overhead and the expenses? Or like, how did you break it down to some employees who might not understand like the complexities of it?
Well, I already knew that 90% of the executives I know don't understand them, so I know the employees aren't, right?
Sure.
But what it became cool was, is they would ask questions. They go, what does this mean? I kind of educated them on the great game of business. Once a quarter, I held a meeting you didn't have to come. It was at a restaurant in North Tampa, like a convention-y, center-y place. And I'd have a breakfast at 7 a.m. on a Saturday morning. We had 400 people attend every quarter, and you didn't have to come. There was no role taken. Now, how do you have 400 people attend your quarterly meeting when you only have 350 employees?
That's a good question, but they must have been really inspired to hear what you had to say.
They brought their wives.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so we engaged them. And then I would go over the financials and the levers and see what the levers are. Like the group I'm working with right now, they sit there and try to, you know, cut the cost of coffee, and they don't realize the breakage of appointment setting is costing us tens of millions of dollars. It's not the price of coffee.
Yeah. What do you feel like was the most impactful or inspiring part of that process when you would share those financials with the team?
Well, we gamified it, and how I learned it was when you really get people involved, they didn't care what I was making. I owned an airplane. They all knew that. I had a skybox at the football place and the hockey. You know, I lived on the water. Everybody knew I made a lot of money. But what happened was they feel involved. And when you're teaching them the great game of business, now they look at levers. I sat there and I worked on a pipe crew. And we're 20 feet deep in August, and I'm sitting there with all the laborers, and they're getting their financials. And I go, what would you do different to increase production? Now, these are freaking laborers, right? Everybody goes, oh, they're just laborers. I go, but they've been laborers for over 10 years, so they probably forgot more than we do, but nobody listens to them. They sat there and told me one day, I'll never forget it, I'm down in the hole with them, and it's summer, and they go, Dean, if we had a hydraulic pipe puller, it could increase our production by 20%. I go, what? What's a hydraulic pipe puller? Because I didn't know anything. They go, you hook it to the bell of the pipe and it's a power pack and it pulls the pipe home. And I said, that would increase production by how much you think? Well, 20%. I go, why don't we have them? They go, oh, they're expensive. Well, this is where people just shut up or people don't ask the right questions. That guy in that ditch at minimum wage, his definition of expensive is different than whose?
The CEO's.
Exactly. So I said, well, what? How expensive is one of those damn things? They go, I bet one of those things costs $1,500. I go, what? The backhoe that was sitting up there that was digging for us was $500,000. The front end loader was $250,000. The bulldozer was $150,000. The two guys picking their nose, our foreman up on the top of the hill, you know, up on the top of the ditch, they were $75,000 a piece. I said, done. So I circled my fingers and the bucket came down. I got in, I pulled up to the top of the ditch. I went over to my two foremen. I go, hey guys, have you ever heard of a hydraulic pipe puller? They go, oh, yeah, I have. I said, what does it do? He says, well, you hook it to the bell and you hook it here and you hit it, it has a portable thing and it brings the pipe home. I go, wow, would one of those increase our production? And these two guys, these old foreman guys, you have been around the industry, they go, you know what? Yeah, I think it would. I go, somebody better get their happy butt in a truck and go to Granger and get one right now. Well, here's what happened out of that instance. What do you think came out of that that was so valuable?
That you could increase revenue by over 20% and with a very small investment, and also just their input, because they're the ones that are doing that work.
They felt heard.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what? People always ask me, I've never had to run an ad to hire a person in my life. Our lobbies were filled every day. Because guess where all these ditch digger guys, you think they drink at different bars? No, they all hang out, you know, they've been in the industry. And so what happened is they felt heard. Well, that traveled through our whole company. And when people feel heard, when you have 350 people feeling heard, that's why we were in 90, whatever it was, the fastest growing company in the state of Florida.
Wow. Yeah, that's powerful.
And it was fun. The big thing, it was fun.
Yeah. Do you ever feel like when you do have the conversations with the employees and listening as a leader is like so important, but when maybe they come to you with an idea or something they want to change that you know isn't going to be a right fit for the business, how do you handle that?
Well, first off, I ask lots of open-ended questions. Like if I know for a fact, and I have known for a fact, something's not perfect for our business. But if it's not going to be detrimental to the business and it's just not my idea and it's maybe not the best, but it's not bad, I'll go ahead and do it just so they have ownership. But I ask a lot of questions, open-ended questions, again, being one of the superpowers. And I'll ask them, so how did you come up with that idea? And they'll start telling me and I'll go, great. And then they'll come up with the math or I'll ask them about the math. What happens is when employees feel empowered, and they learn how the levers work and you gamify it. Oh, can I tell you one funny story about what I learned how to gamify when I was very young? This is my other big lesson in life.
Yes, I would love to hear it.
My dad got me a job when I was 16 years old, 17, between my junior and senior year in high school, working for a concrete bridge building, you know, those beams for bridge building.
Mm-hmm.
And he got me this job as a laborer because he wanted me to work hard. Well, I already worked hard and I didn't want to go to Vietnam. Nobody did. So I was going to go to college. Anyway, he gets me this job during the summer because his buddy owned this big pre-stressed concrete company. So I'm out there. Well, the first day I'm there, Beth, a bus pulls up. You know, at 7 o'clock is when we start. The bus pulls up at 6:45. Guess where the bus was from?
No clue.
Jail. Prison.
Oh.
So half of each one of the four crews are prisoners. The other half of the four crews probably should be in jail, okay?
Oh, gosh.
Or have been in jail in the past. So I'm working with pretty tough people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a junior guy. I'm a high schooler, so they're treating me like, you know, a grunt. But I noticed something the first 2 weeks I was there in the summer. Every day at 10 and 2, we had a break. And these guys would go over and they start pitching pennies towards the wall and screaming and cussing, I kicked your butt. And that's what turned me on to understand that people love to win. And I looked at them, and so after a week or so of that, I got with my crew, and I'm the young guy, and I go, hey guys, let's bet the other three crews a quarter of man that we can tie our steel, get our beds inspected, pour our concrete, and get them signed off on before they do each day, quarter of man. will kick their butts. You in? Now I'm a 17-year-old kid, and they go, hell yes. So we started betting every day. The four crews, we'd bet amongst ourselves a quarter a man that whoever would win would get the 75 cents, right? Per man. Well, about three quarters of the summer, I'm at home, and Mr. Young, who owns the Priestress Company, is there with my dad having a beer in the backyard. That's how I got this great job. I overhear him. And Mr. Young says, and this changed my world too. Mr. Young says to my dad, he goes, Don, I don't know what the hell's going on out at my plant, but my production's up over 20% for no reason.
And what do you think that reason was?
We, amongst ourselves, gamified it. The company had nothing to do with it. Now I do it with my companies. I did it with all my companies, but we gamified it. These guys were betting against each other, the quarter a man, for production. Had nothing to do with the company.
And they were engaged. It was the engagement of it.
But it was amongst us. It wasn't the management busting our
sure.
butts about y'all got to work hard. When I sat there and had our group bet the other three groups a quarter man, hey, guess what, guys? I already knew they loved winning. I go, we'll bet you a quarter man that we can tie our steel, get our beds approved before you. You in? And they all go, hell yeah. And we just started betting amongst ourselves.
That's awesome. I love your stories, Dean. You have so many stories. We could have like a 5-hour podcast and longer. I love it. They're so fun.
You're one of my favorite people. I use you as an example all the time. The Queef Course stories and stuff, and how you were one of the top producer at Ideal Image, and everybody in Miami be bitching, blah, blah, blah. And I go, talk to Beth. I mean, she's sitting in a marketplace that she shouldn't even exist in.
I love it. So tell me some of the stories you've told about me.
I tell stories all the time about how you engage the customer and the patients. And at the time, you even engaged your people. Like I would come up and we would go out to dinner with everybody. You're a very engaging person. We haven't talked in years, but you also really have a sixth sense of learning how to engage a customer, ask those questions and shutting up at the time. And I'm confident you're probably still a master at that.
Yeah, and I love that because I think it's all about hitting those emotional triggers and believing in what you do, of course, and just, you know, being passionate about what you do. But more importantly, what we're talking about today, like competition, price, and the economy does not affect you unless that's just what your mindset's about. And I've seen it time and time again in my career where people use that as an excuse and it's not even a thing.
Well, when you do the three circles with anybody that bitches about the economy or price or whatever, I went into a crane company and I turned it around. We took it from $37 million to over $100 million in 3 years. And all we did was I got salesmen to go lose sales, and you'll laugh at this. This is way outside. When I brought them all in and I looked at all our lead volume and the sales in the marketplace of the three circles, I paid salespeople to go call on customers in the second circle, and I raised our prices 25% in a recession. What do you think all the salespeople thought when I raised prices? And this was a 35-year-old company. When I raised prices 25% in a recession.
Well, it depends what kind of salespeople they were. I would have been excited about it, but a lot of people would probably be taken back from it.
Well, they were talking about the economy and all that crap. Everybody does. So I raised the prices 25%. $37 million, we had dropped from $50 million to 37, and I raised the price. And I brought all the team from the state of Florida in because we were all in the state. And I stood up there, and half of them knew me because I had been involved with the company. And now I'm the CEO, and I go, we're raising prices 25%. And this whole room of these crane sales guys and all these people in there, and they're all like, what? We're in a recession. I go, but here's what the numbers were. And I knew what the three circles were because I was able to get the gross sales by our SIC codes in the peninsula of Florida. So I knew it was $350 million, and we were at $37 million. And I asked them what they closed, and I said, let's assume we lost $37 million. Now they were all like, oh, we didn't lose that much. I said, let's just go with it. So 37, 37, 74, I took it against the 350, and it was $276 million. And I had this whole room of guys, and I go, We lost $276 million in a recession for one reason, which was why?
You were undercharging?
We didn't even know about it. They didn't call us for price. This was the second circle. They didn't even know we exist, or they didn't call us, or whatever the reason was. So I raised the prices 25% for circle two, and I told all my sales team, I said, I'm going to pay you 100% commission for every sale you lose. So now you'll make more money because I'm going to pay you a commission on a higher price.
Wow.
And so they went out to prove me wrong. That year, the first year we did it, we did $62 million, $12 million more than their biggest 35-year history in a recession. The next year we did $82 million, and the next year we did $103 million, and I exited.
I love it.
We made so much money, it was stupid.
You inspire me. I love it. That's amazing.
It's fun.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
You know what I teach my ninjas, all my sales teams now?
I'm sure you teach them a lot, but I want to hear a few things.
I teach them. It's very simple. Be a two-year-old.
I like that.
Because what is a two-year-old? If a two-year-old wants a cookie,
they're not afraid to ask. They're going to ask for the cookie.
And not only are they going to ask for the cookie, they're going to bug the crap out of you till when?
Till they get the cookie.
Exactly.
I love that.
So I get all my teams. I go, you got to be a two-year-old. Just bug them. Well, they'll get mad at me. Oh, well. Be a two-year-old. You think if you get mad at a two-year-old and say, you go sit in the corner for an hour, you can't have a cookie. You think the two-year-old sits over there and reminisces back, man, I shouldn't ask for the cookie. Now I'm sitting here, I'm never going to get a cookie. No, the two-year-old sit there and then they walk back up to you after the hour and do what?
Get another cookie.
Exactly.
The true thing about the two-year-old kind of, you know, story that you're giving right now is they're fearless. Be fearless.
Exactly.
That is so powerful. I love that.
Learn to shut up and learn to ask questions and learn to believe. The three circles will shock anybody. When that guy who was arrogant sitting on the front says, yeah, we do $1 billion in revenue. And I said, if you had 100% market share of the market you serve, what would the third circle be? And the guys actually wrote it. I mean, I was shocked because I had a whole group of YPO CEOs in there and he's up on the front row being his arrogant self. And when he wrote he wrote $1 billion in sales and he wrote $1 trillion in sales in circle three. And I went, you lost nine. And I gave him $1 billion of sales he would have lost because he was on the deal and lost it. I said, you lost $998 billion in revenue because of one reason. You didn't even freaking know about it. This guy, like I said, he's in his plane. I mean, you know, it's comical.
What you don't know, you don't know.
So in your business, if you take your business, you sit there and you go, our average customer is this and this and this. And by the way, if you ever need it, Beth, you can call me and I'll do a demographic analysis for you. I got this software I already pay for anyway. And it shows you how by age groups, where they are, and you can do radiuses, 10 miles, 20 miles, 50 miles. And what happens when you start finding all the facts, you suddenly realize that the opportunity, your market share, it's not about anything other than YOU in the mirror.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You're a stud. You know that. So.
Aw, you're a stud. I have been so inspired by you, and you have been a big part of where I am today. And I love your stories and I love chatting with you. If you could leave our listeners with one mindset shift that could change everything for them, what would it be?
That if you're in business, believe in yourself and understand that price, competition, the economy are not your enemy. Your biggest enemy is staring you in the mirror.
Amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that. This conversation has been packed with so much wisdom, strategy, and motivation. And I love how you break down the myths of the external factors and how they can control success and how people think that. It's clear that mindset, strategy, and execution are the real game changers. If you found this episode to fire you up, make sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share with a friend. And remember, your success isn't dictated by the economy, your competition, or even your prices. It's all about your mindset, actions, and resilience. Thanks again, Dean. And to all of you out there listening, keep hustling with heart.
There you have it. Another episode of Hustle and Heart. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review on your app and connect with me on social media so you don't miss a beat. I'll see you next time on the Hustle and Heart podcast.